author of the week on Radio Gorgeous.
We'll meet again. Don't know where. Don't know when.
Fashion on the Ration, Style and the Second World War by Julie Summers, Part 1. Fashion, as we know, goes in circles. It's fashionable now not to buy fashion which has been made in China or sweatshops. The truly fashionable source their clothes from second-hand shops and vintage stores, upcycling clothes for ethical reasons. But in the Second World War, people were forced to forgo everyday fashions and scrimp and sew and darn. It was fashion on the ration. And today, to talk about her paperback coming out this month, I'm very happy to welcome Julie Summers, author, who has also written two other books too, When the Children Came Home and Stranger in the House. Fashion on the Ration was also an exhibition at the Imperial War Museum in London 2015. Hi, Julie, and welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So, Julie, I'm sitting here today in my Page jeans, my Massimo Dutti boots and my Swedish designer jacket. What would I and you have been wearing if it was 1940?
If it was 1940, we would have probably been wearing corsets. Because we are of an age, and in the war, 19 million women wore corsets, so that's really everybody over 20. We would have been wearing stockings. There were still some silk stockings available. Bare legs were unacceptable. Under our corsets, maybe cami knickers, and then probably, you and me, a tweed skirt, a top that was possibly a cotton or a silk blouse, and a cardigan.
Gosh, so we all probably look the same and dress the same.
Well, certainly in 1940, there was a look that middle-aged women had, which is much older than we are now. They probably look 20 years older than we do today.
Well, they wouldn't have had the hair dye, the makeup, the Botox.
They had the hairdos. They had waves, so everybody had a permanent wave. They did have a little bit of makeup, but it was war paint. It was paint that had, it was. Makeup that had come really from the theatre and from Hollywood. So it was sort of fairly pasty stuff. Lipstick was big, dark red lipstick. But I think the key thing was that they would have looked more old-fashioned because the basic dress was tweed for a skirt and then a sort of cashmere sweater.
You know, I wore tweed up in Yorkshire this weekend and I realised that it is the warmest thing to wear and it's brilliant in Britain because of the dampness.
Tweed is very popular and it remains popular for outdoor sports because it does exactly that. It draws in the damp. But it also is a very good windproof garment. And women wore tweed skirts on grouse moors. In fact, they were discouraged from wearing tweed trousers because you couldn't go behind a bush and have a quick pee, but you can in a skirt. You preserve your modesty. But women did wear skirts.
It's so funny you said that, because I was literally lying in bed last night thinking, why has it always been that women wear skirts? And do you think it's that exact reason for going to the loo?
Yes, it's entirely practical. And certainly out on a grouse moor, where there is no shrubbery high enough to hide you if you want to relieve yourself, in a skirt you can discreetly bend down.
But I was wondering whether it was so a man could take advantage of you. You know, I was...
Oh, you're being very negative about men. I think women were more independent like about that in the 1940s. At least I hope they were.
So you've told me what I'm wearing. Now, can you tell us about utility clothing? We know about utility furniture, but what was utility clothing and would we as middle-class women have worn it?
Yes, and we would have been absolutely delighted to wear it because utility clothing was bred from utility cloth. So what happened was that the government realised that clothes rationing wasn't enough. They still needed to save more material. So they produced utility cloth, which meant that there could be great long runs of mass-produced garments, so dresses or shirts or coats or skirts or whatever. And these garments were made up to patterns. And very quickly, the government realised that it couldn't possibly afford to produce boring, dull, bad design. So it had the total masterstroke of employing the best designers in the country. So Hartnell, Digby Morton, Edward Molyneux, Bianca Mosca, Elsbeth Champcominal, all these people designed utility clothes for a fraction of the price that their clothes would have cost if you'd gone and bought them in Jaeger or Fortnum & Mason's. So for 30 shillings, you could buy a dress or a coat designed by Digby Morton, designed and mass-produced on the utility scale. But I mean, the key thing about utility was that it was mass-produced, but it was far better quality than you or I might imagine
So it's like a kind of diffusion line now, but at a really even a better price.
Yes, it was. And it didn't carry purchase tax, whereas if you'd insisted on buying, if you like, ready-made garments that weren't utility, you had to pay 30 to 80% purchase tax, which, of course, was a bit more of an issue. So they were cheaper, they were very well made, and they were popular, and they were brightly coloured.
Brightly coloured. Now, yes. You always think, because you see only black and white photos, but it would have been, you know, quite a grey time.
I know, and it's a very usual perception of the war, but actually the one thing that wasn't rationed was colour. And so the designers made sure that they had beautiful colours in their clothes. So very
what
often
kind of emerald colours, sort of. But, I mean jewel colours.
Jewel colours, but also very deep reds and ochres were popular. Mustard yellow, and it doesn't sound very promising, but a really strong mustard yellow with as a base colour with a bright colour on top in the pattern could look sensational. And there's a wonderful dress designed in 1944 that is, it looks completely modern. It looks like a Bridget Riley, and it's purple, black, white, and cerise, and it's absolutely beautiful.
That's really heartening, actually.
RadioGorgeous.com.
So what happened was the war started, and then Britain had to save on every kind of front that it had. And part of it was that the cloth had to be used for the war effort.
Well, to make it as simple as possible, when the war broke out, two things happened. 15 million people had to have uniforms made for them, including a vast number in the armed forces. So half of all clothes production went from being civilian to military. So half of clothes production was dressing about a third of the population. So half the population, or half the clothes production, was dressing the other two thirds. So QED, there wasn't nearly enough manufacturing. And then as the war went on, and the battle for the Atlantic meant that there was shipping space was very much at a premium, so there wasn't as much material coming into Britain. That was when the houses realised they had to limit the amount of clothes that people could wear. And so in June 1941, the government introduced clothes rationing in the hopes that it would reduce people's desire to buy clothes. And it did. It worked.
And what about coupons? Because I've heard so much about coupons. I remember my granny talking about them. What did it mean?
So what happened was that after the 1st of June 1941, you as an adult and actually as a child were given 66 clothing coupons. And with those coupons, you could buy a skirt for 8 coupons, a pair of socks for 2 or 3, depending on what length of socks. An overcoat would cost you 18 coupons or 16 if it was a gabardine. So you were limited to 66 coupons worth of clothes per year. You could spend your coupons in any shop, which is different from food, where you had to register with a grocer or a shopkeeper. So you could spend your coupons in any shop, but it wasn't guaranteed that you would be able to buy what you wanted.
If you loved, you know, Parisian, you know, couture or something, could you get that?
Well, you could at a price.
Okay.
It was...
So the wealthy were
Absolutely, the wealthy were okay. So they could still buy fur coats if they wanted. It attracted 100% purchase tax. So a coat that had been worth £30 before the war was worth £60 or £100 during the war. People did still try and buy fashionable clothes and have clothes made up. But the majority, so people like me, would not have been able to afford those kind of clothes. So we would have had to go and buy from stores and take potluck. And you didn't always get matching stockings. I know, absolutely.
What?
So people just bought one colour of stockings so that in the hope that if one pair got a ladder in one leg, they could simply take a stocking from another pair.
Now let's talk about darning and things, because obviously your stockings would get ladders in them. Were they, I mean, nowadays we just throw away everything. Was it about darning and mending?
Yes, and there's a lovely quote in the book from a woman called Flo Hyatt, who complained that her underwear and her stockings were more darns than stocking and silk. And you can imagine that, can't you? But people were incredibly deft. My mother, who's now 81, she can still turn a heel on a sock. And she can turn a collar on a shirt because she was taught to by her mother during the war.
What does that mean?
Well, it means that when you're actually stitching a sock, you produce the right angle that gives you the heel. So you don't just go a tubular sock, but you actually have a sock that's got a right angle in it. And when you turn a collar, it's when you've got a collar that is one way on a shirt and you take it off and you simply turn it and you put it back on the other way. So you use a collar twice.
That's so good, because my husband's got lots of ragged shirts. I could just turn over the
collars. Oh, I think that's an obvious thing for you to do of the evenings.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, this is the fascinating thing, that people were very much more skilled than we are nowadays at needlework. And for those who couldn't darn or mend, there were shops that would... There were little booths in shops where you could pay a shilling to have your stockings mended and, you know, sixpence to have your socks mended. And they did a pretty brisk trade.
So most middle-class women could make clothes, could they?
Yes, I think that's absolutely fair to say. And they certainly made their own children's clothes. Baby clothes were very easy to make, and people did make them. And then people who couldn't make clothes but who could afford to would have a dressmaker. And there were something like 10,000 dressmakers in Britain during the Second World War, the outbreak of the Second World War.
Amazing. So that was just, that was all before ready-to-wear, really, wasn't it?
Well, ready-to-wear was just coming in. So Marks & Sparks was developing, or Marks & Spencer was developing good lines with better dye, so the material was a better quality. Dickens & Jones, Bourne & Hollingworth, these were shops that had mass-produced clothes for sale at a price, but at a price that is a lot more proportionally than what we would spend in shops today, because they weren't made in sweatshops. They were made, manufactured in Britain.
So they were good quality then?
By and large, the middle classes and the upper classes could buy very good quality clothes. The working classes before the war had atrocious quality clothing. They were sold through very cheap shops, and there was a sort of scheme whereby somebody could set aside money on a weekly basis, and they would buy clothing coupons. This is pre-war. And then they would spend those clothing coupons on clothes at a certain shop, and that shop might sell clothes and underwear and false teeth and any goods that you might want. But they were tied to this one department store. And one of the effects of the Second World War was to make much better quality clothing available to the working classes. And that was a hidden benefit of the war.
That's really interesting, because it really was a massive cultural change, because working class again said, after war, we want homes, we want health. So, you know what I mean? It was like they were suddenly thinking, no, I want it different, weren't they?
Yes, and thank goodness they did. I mean, I think one of the really interesting stories is of the post-depression of the 1930s going into full employment in the Second World War. The upshot was that people had money, and because there was so little available, people couldn't spend all the money they wanted on clothes and shoes because they simply weren't there. People learned to have more money and savings, and so after the war they wanted to be able to spend it, and they wanted, as you rightly say, better housing, better health. By the end of the war, there was the Butler Education Act had been passed. There was free school milk for children. There were free dinners for children under a certain income. You know, a lot of good stuff was happening. The National Health Service had been born. And the working classes were really, in many ways, beneficiaries from the Second World War.
Well, it's in a way, it's the invention of modern age, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
So I want to ask about knitting and crocheting, and how were they used in the war effort?
Well, there are two things going on here. So the first is that everybody knitted for themselves, for their babies, for their grandmothers. Everybody had a pair of knitting needles and access to wool. So there was sort of domestic knitting. And then on a much bigger scale, there was knitting for the forces, so comforts for the troops. You could supply socks and gloves and knitted helmets to the Red Cross to send out to prisons of war. The dear old Women's Institute, who were tremendously energetic, as I'm sure you can imagine, knitted for the Merchant Navy 60,000 sets of welly boot socks, tank tops, gloves, fingerless gloves and helmets, and big woolly jumpers. And those were knitted between September 39 and February 1940. 60,000 sets, and then a further 60,000 sets by April.
Unbelievable. Yeah. And just think how much comfort they gave these people. I mean, as we know, being uncomfortable and cold is the worst thing.
There is the most lovely letter written by a merchant seaman, because the merchant seamen were very much forgotten. They weren't glamorous like the Navy, but they were tremendously brave, and they were bringing in our food and our munitions and our clothes from convoys going across the Atlantic.
In fact, they were bombed more than anyone else.
Yes, they were. And they were so brave. And these WI sets went off to the merchant seamen. And there's a most wonderful letter written to the chairman, Lady Denman, by a seaman, describing the look of sheer delight in his sailors' eyes when they got their package of six garments from the WI, and how much it meant to those men to think that there was somebody in the country caring enough for them to knit them clothes so they'd be able to be warm. It's very moving. There are some lovely stories.
Now, what about shoes? Because I think of 1940s, I think of sort of slightly kind of platforms and a chunky heel. Was that the look?
Well, it changed. So at the beginning of the war, there were strappy sandals, but those went out very quickly because they were impractical. Because there were only 11% of the number of cars on the roads by 1943 that there had been pre-war, people had to walk very much further. So people wore clumpy, sensible lace-up shoes. Until 1942, which was when Singapore fell and the Japanese had basically control of most of the world's rubber, people could still get their shoes resoled and rehealed. But after 42, rubber was at a premium. Vets were allowed Wellington boots, but vets' assistants weren't. Farmers had to wear clogs. And shoes came in called woodies, and they were wooden-soled shoes with an articulated piece, a sort of split at the middle of the foot of the shoe, so that you could actually sort of walk on it, like an articulated clog. Incredibly uncomfortable, I think. But the other thing about shoes in the war was that there were multicoloured shoes. And the reason was because there was a shortage of leather. So a multicoloured shoe meant you could use small offcuts of leather rather than having to get one big piece of black.
Like patchwork.
Yeah. Exactly. So yeah. Patchwork became very, very familiar. Yeah. And the reason there was a shortage of leather was because the government commissioned Argentina to supply meat to Britain.
Bully beef, yeah.
Bully beef. And the most efficient way of doing it, saving shipping space, was to telescope the meat, that is deboning it, and removing the leather.
Oh,
and the unintended consequence was that we were short of leather and short of bones. So we were short of bones for the munitions industry, and we were short of bones for making glue, but we were short of leather for shoes.
Listen out for part two of Fashion on the Russian by Julie Summers on RadioGorgeous.com.
We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again. Some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know, tell them I won't be long.
RadioGorgeous.com.